If there was anything I could do for him, I'd do it. As long as he said, do it for me. But he just doesn't do that. He doesn't reach out.
In 30 years as CEO of two highly successful AFL clubs, Brian Cook has seen and lived more than most in football. There's been stunning success, a few setbacks, and a lot of tough conversations with a lot of people. Here, he lets us in on some key facets of that football journey. Brian Cook, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Damien. Thanks for having me on.
You've been a high-profile part of a high-profile industry for a very long time now. I don't mean this to sound too simplistic, but what has been the key to that longevity?
To surviving.
To surviving.
I could be sarcastic here and say winning games, but there's certainly something in that.
It helps though, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It really does. Look, I end up doing a master's degree, first one of its type in West Australia, a master's degree in education, but it was in brackets leisure studies, the studies of people and their engagement and what they did during their leisure time, whether it be holidays or hotels or going to the football or whatever the case may be, so, and why people play and why people compete. So, I did my thesis in participative planning methods in sport and recreation. And so I was at quite a young age developing techniques on how to collaborate, participative structures, participative processes, more to the point, on how to involve people in decision making and in their planning so that they actually owned their territory. And so that was my uniqueness then, and I think it's kept me relevant. So to answer it really simply, I know I've been long-winded about it.
Yeah.
It's basically, I think, being really collaborative and being team-driven has kept me relevant.
Yeah. The winning component, I know you sort of said it flippantly there, but it obviously is a key, isn't it? The two clubs you've spent the longest periods of time at, initially West Coast, now Geelong, they're winning football clubs, aren't they? They're winning premierships and they're winning seasons. It's obviously a key because other people would have been in the game for nearly as long but not considered as successful because of the team component to it.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been sustained success in both clubs. We never missed the finals in the 10 years I was there at the West Coast Eagles, and we've missed, I think, four times maybe at Geelong in 20 years. And so it's not just getting there once. It's a matter of getting there over and over again. And hopefully improving each year.
And is that on the CEO's head, Brian, in your eyes? Because you hear some people in footy say, well, all I can do is my portfolio and the team is separate. And is there washing of hands for people who view it that way?
No, I think the leader, of course, is the leadership is shared by the board and the executive. And, of course, in football, the coaches and the senior players. And so it's really shared. But at the end of the day, the CEO has the day-to-day responsibility of running the club, and the club is a whole lot of departments. It's not just one. And so I think that I do have a responsibility to look over the entire club and oversee it. And when you're not performing on the field, it's easy to say it's not your fault. But if you're the person part of a board who picks the coach and the captain and all of its leaders, you do have a role and you do have an accountability. So if the same board picks four or five leaders in a row and they're no good or they don't perform, then it's up to the board to do something about themselves.
Mm.
So I have that sort of attitude.
Yeah. The contract you've got 2 years to run, which will take it to 31 years in total as a chief executive officer of the two clubs you've spoken about. I think we in football know you well enough to know this is not going to be a two-year farewell for you, is it? You'll be working as hard as ever, I'd imagine.
No, I want to make sure that we perform at our very best on and off the field and achieve the business planning KPIs that we've got. We stay true to our mission, we stay true to our values, and, we lead like we've been leading for a little while. It won't be a honeymoon farewell, that's for sure. But when I do retire, I think I will be riding into the sunset, waving goodbye to everyone rather than partying, that's for sure.
And will you retire from football?
I don't know. It's hard to say what I'll do in a couple of years' time. I'll probably have my finger in the pie, some pies, I would say. I don't think I could retire completely. You go from working, 60 hours a week or whatever it is to not working at all. I've got a few other roles outside of football now, so I'm sort of in a transitional period, to be honest, quite now, right now. I'm chair of Barwon Health Board, and they have 7,000 employees, and they turn over $700 million a year. So that's a pretty big task, and I'm also on the Slade Group of Companies board. So, and I'm also on Wombat's Wish as an ambassador, which is a cause close to my heart. So I'm doing three or four other things at the moment. It's a bit of a transition.
Yep. Would you consider transferring your responsibilities of Geelong Football Club, for instance, from chief executive to chairman? If the opportunity arose?
You don't get paid as the chairman, mate.
So no.
Oh, look, I don't really want to put my head in that ring at this stage. I mean, there's plenty of really good people who are in line for that rather than me. I think it's a bit difficult going from CEO to chair for a lot of reasons, but I think... And the other thing is staying around the club as sort of a part-time consultant, whatever the case may be, also has its issues if the new CEO doesn't want you around.
Yeah.
And you've got to take that into consideration.
Yep. 1990, when you walked into West Coast as CEO, having had the relationship prior to that through other jobs and roles, 14 teams in the AFL competition, obviously, back then. We've now got 18. Has football over that time frame, 1990 to now, done as well as it could have?
Done as well as it could have. Oh, gee. I've always felt it was an unbelievable sport to participate in and administrate. I've always felt myself very fortunate and lucky to be in this environment. When you look back, you always think, maybe we could have done it this way, or the industry could have led this way. But by and large, it's been a very good industry, very good industry. Has it been a great industry to be a part of? I think for most people it is. And the only thought I have in terms of how it might have been a better industry is if some time ago people were a little bit more serious about their values and their value-based leadership models. But it took a little bit of time. But having said that, I think we're well ahead of a lot of other sports in that area right now.
Yeah,
I suppose I'm a bit of an idealist in this area. I probably take it too far at times, so I admit that personally. But I've actually seen what it can do.
Yeah.
And I think that if the AFL had a really solid set of values, say 15 or 20 years ago, and really worked hard at them and appointed their leaders based on those values, we'd be even in a better place at this stage.
That being a point of difference that you've often referred to between this game and other sporting codes, the values set, and that would have even been a greater point of difference, is that?
I don't know of any sport that's been great on its values, if I can be really honest, in terms of where I see values being great as a measurement. Maybe I'm being harsh.
Compromises made for people and actions? Is that what you're getting at here?
Yeah, I think there's two or three things. There's compromises made for talented people who get too many chances, and I think they should. We should have a supportive and welfare system, but I think at times when the crunch comes and we need to make a decision about some of those people with poor values, we go the easy route. So I think that's one thing. And the other thing that I think about a lot is when deals are more important than developing substance. Yeah. And so I think we have at times been, some people have accused the AFL of being deal makers and clubs being deal makers and worrying about getting big sponsorships and increasing pricing, doing all those things instead of developing substance in the organisation. Because if you do great broadcast deals and you do great sponsor deals, you get all the money and you don't have to worry about the substance necessarily.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go substance first, I think, in my opinion, you will have a much better long-term sustainability.
Okay. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but when you refer to compromising ourselves and putting the deal over the substance, are there some examples, Brian, you're happy to share with today about these matters?
No, not really. I mean, I could share a few stories, but I think when I first got to Geelong, if I could do this in a generic manner, when I got to Geelong, it was really and it's in the DNA of Geelong. It was very much about individual talent and worshipping talent. Whether it be Gary Ablett Senior or Besto or whoever in terms of those champions. So there was never, when I arrived at Geelong, there was no real value, behavioural value around the importance of team, in my opinion, not strong enough, you know. And so that's what I'm referring to, you know, around the importance of values.
Is that what happened at Essendon in your eyes?
Probably, yes, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too opinionated about these things, but I don't know all the facts. But, you know, when you play around the threshold, you might go over the edge. That's always a chance, you know. And I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of the Essendon issue now. But when you have a close to a win at all costs attitude, my opinion doesn't always work.
No. The link, I suppose, just as we move this conversation to this next space, Brian, Mark Thompson being a coach that you had time with at Geelong and a successful coach, him also being involved in the Essendon situation, there's a crossover period there where even Frank Costa last year said he, in hindsight, felt that Mark Thompson's issues could be traced back to the time between the first and second premierships. Other players have said similar things. Do you feel that yourself when you reflect on where Mark Thompson finds himself today?
Yeah, probably. I think that's probably the time where he was most vulnerable behaviourally. I think so. Yeah, it's a difficult issue because you know when you identify employees who aren't necessarily performing at their best for a little period of time, it could be anything. You know, without going into all the possibilities, the bundle of things. You know, and you know early intervention is really important. I think we tried to do that in 06, yeah, end of 06, start of 07.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about intervention is you need people's support, you know, not just the actual person you're dealing with in terms of their behaviour, people around them and how – because the matter could get worse if the players and a few others are behaving so erratically, you know. Anyway, I think we got to a stage where we were trying to be really open – with Mark, but it was difficult to get a response. He just doesn't give. You know, he was the type of guy who was self-made, and he didn't necessarily want to rely on other people or give people his problems. He didn't want to talk about any of the issues he had, and so it was difficult. It was really difficult. We were trying to create a safe and open and genuine environment for Mark to talk to us about whatever it was, but we never really got to that stage.
Yeah. And when you go back to that, Bron, I mean, you had the review that was very public at the time. And again, people knowing you, you would have done that because you had to do that at that time for that footy club. And then to hear you talk now, even beyond that review, that there were some issues that you felt you ideally would have needed to address if you could have, it must have been a tough time.
It was a tough time. Yeah, it really was. And in the end, what you do is you believe what the people are saying to you, in reflection, was I naive? Yeah, maybe there was a part of that, but by and large, there were good people that we were dealing with, including Mark Thompson, good people, and I believe they were telling me the truth. And when we asked Mark questions, he would tell us what I thought was the truth, and we had no need to really worry about it.
I know you mean when you say it's easy in hindsight to look back and why didn't we ask questions, why didn't we do things, but to ask someone the sort of questions you probably wanted to, it opens up a whole new relationship component, doesn't it?
If they
push back on you.
Yeah. Oh, it does. And you know, Mark wasn't the only person that I've had to deal with in terms of asking very direct and honest questions. And you'll find every CEO that's been in football for some time has had to interview and deal with people in a very open and I think very open and very direct way.
Yeah.
And ask them very direct questions, whether it be around, you know, drugs or behaviour or whatever, you know.
It's part of your responsibility, isn't it, for your club as well as the people around you?
Yeah, the people around me and I. It's much more sophisticated now in terms of how you handle it. We're much better at it because we've got qualified people in mental health issues. We've got qualified people in psychology now. So it's you rely on those people a lot more than 10 or 15 years ago when they were available possibly on a part-time or casual basis and you brought them in or out. But now they're available pretty much full time, thanks to the AFLPA and just our own resources, and so we're much more professional in the way we handle that. But 10 or 15 years ago, it wasn't like
that. No, it wasn't. Was it?
No.
And it's in a relatively short time frame.
It has.
It's changed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ask Mark Thompson if he was using drugs in that period?
I did. Yes. Yeah. I don't want to go into that.
Yeah.
Sorry, mate. No, I think that's a personal thing, really.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously the awareness of the club, though, is was there at the time. But
oh, yeah, no, yeah. It was in the papers. It was people were talking about it. And so, you know, the question had to be asked.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. When you see where he's at now, Brian, I mean, I know how close you were as a group, and I know how much the memories of that great period were together, not just the premierships.
Yeah.
When you see him now, what is it you feel?
I haven't seen Mark for over a year. But I feel for him.
Mm.
You know, I could use the words disappointed and let down, but no, it's beyond that now. It's not about his footy performance. It's about him as a person, and I know the skills he had. I know the talent he has. I know the dad that he was, you know, or is, and to see what's happened is just. If there was anything I could do for him, I'd do it. As long as he said, do it for me. But he just doesn't do that. He doesn't reach out.
Mm. Yeah, Frank Costa made the similar observations. Mm. And he's always a Geelong person. And as such, you've always got his back, no matter what you went through.
He's welcome back at Geelong anytime for anything. I just want to see Mark be healthy of mind and body.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to even worry about his footy and his background.
Yeah.
As a person, and as a person I love, we just want him to get better.
Yep. Brian, dealing with those sorts of issues, I mean, they're the public ones. There's probably equally as serious matters you're regularly dealing with as a CEO for 31 years in the game, as it will be in 2 years' time. How does that affect you, just being that person for so many people?
I think we get better at it, and so it's easier. People might think it gets harder because the issues are more complicated, and there's a point in that, but there's much more support than what there was, okay? Mm. So I think if you've got a supportive mentality, then you're on the right track. No matter what the issue is, you know, there's got to be some level of support in it. You know, football is the most accountable experience job that I'm aware of, you know, that people train and play 20 hours a week and they get a video at the end of the week which goes for a minute. And that minute has their most accountable moments on it, But what I've learned is that you want that video to be excellent in 6 years' time, and for that to be excellent, you've got to have so much support around the players, dietitians, psychologists, statisticians, data analysts, blah, blah, blah. So the more accountability you want, the more support you have to provide.
Mm.
And I think that theme in life is not so bad, whether it be with your kids or with your workers or with anyone. If you're after accountability, you've got to provide support.
Mm. Brian, even talking about these moments here, when you set out in football as a player, a lot of VFL games, reserve games for Hawthorn, and then the four senior VFL games for Melbourne back in 1977, you had a man by the name of Bobby Skilton
Bobby.
As your coach. Did you ever think what you've dealt with over the next 40 so years was what it was going to be when you just tried to play a couple of games of footy back then?
No, not at all. No. I was actually studying to be a phys ed teacher at Rustin College when I was playing for Melbourne. So I think it was in my third or fourth year, and funny enough, I was brought up in Dorcas Street, South Melbourne. So my role model was and my god, my footy god was Bobby Skilton in number 14 on the back down at Albert Park Lake. You know, the oval down there was fantastic. So I used to walk down from Dorcas Street to go watch him, and he was the man, the chimp that we used to watch, you know, all the time. And for him to be my coach, you know, some years later, about 18 years later or so, it was amazing. He was he's a first-class citizen, loved him as a person. I think he struggled with the talent he had or didn't have at Melbourne, but he was really, you know, just a first-class citizen.
Mm. I was checking the records books just before this, and the four games you played were consecutive matches, around 11, 12, 13, 14, and that was it. So
That was it. I went from Hawthorn Reserves, played about 50 games there, and went over to Melbourne for a year. And played four games there, but they had this system where it was the sort of the regular system at the time. If you played more than four games, you had to pay an extra transfer fee. So a lot of players got to four games.
Okay.
There's actually the four game club, you know, around the place, and you know, we have a laugh about it. But I played my first game on Foundation Day against was it Queen's Birthday Day against Collingwood?
Was it?
Yeah, and I played on both Max and Wayne Richardson, and I think I did a good job. So, and I think that, but the next three I didn't do so well. I don't think so. I was out 4 games.
Fair enough. And I noticed also to the record books say that in that year you ran in the grand final mile race.
Yeah,
you're a miler.
Yeah, I was a miler at the time. Mm. You know, I was a slow. I couldn't sprint much, but I could run a long way. You know, and. No, I was very, very fit, but I wasn't quick.
Okay. And that was at halftime of that game?
That was at halftime, yeah.
Of the drawn grand final.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. Yeah, my memory doesn't suit me too at the moment. I think maybe it was out at Waverley, anyway.
Maybe one of the prelim finals, maybe. Anyway. Right in their style and swim. I think you've spoken about this before, but you're in the water for how many hours?
Anywhere between 7 and 10.
Yeah. Mm. And like they, when you, the waves were just so big and the tide was so big, you were swimming for. I think you said at one stage you made about 15 metres over amount of hours.
Yeah, there was one time it was about an hour and I made about 100 metres max because I went over the same rock and I said to my skipper who was on the boat, I stopped swimming and I said, I think I've seen that rock before. And I said, how am I going? And he said, no, you're not doing too well, Cookie. You've done 100 metres the last hour. And, oh, my goodness, what are we going to do about this? So I ended up swimming sideways to try and get out of the current that we're in.
Right. So when you're in those moments, Brian, obviously it's tough, and people who haven't done that wouldn't have a proper realisation of being in that moment. But what do you do? When's the willpower kick in, and how does it kick in for you in those moments?
Look, I can't answer that. I can answer it honestly, but I don't know the real reason, apart from saying I think I've developed a fair bit of resilience over time. And I'm quite an endurable soul, so they both go hand in hand. I say to myself when I'm swimming, the longer I swim in my head, I say I'm getting stronger, and so I'm stronger at the 15K mark when I've swam 15Ks than what I was at the 5.
Okay.
So I try and convince myself of how strong I am. And endurable I am in making sure I get to the finish.
It's obviously an important part of your life, isn't it? It obviously sets your year up as well. But, can you see yourself see a time when you won't do it? Is it too hard?
I'll stop swimming when I can't swim.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. I'll keep swimming until I can't.
Fair enough. You've had a lot of strong personalities around you, particularly at Geelong. Obviously, they're at West Coast too, but the ones that are more recent. Obviously, Mark Thompson, we spoke about. You've had Cameron Ling, Tom Harley, the current captain, Joel Sell. They're strong people, aren't they?
Yeah.
Giving people their heads in a situation where you're their boss, what's the key to that?
Oh, you've got to give them elbow room to make an error or two, but also give them elbow room to display what they've got. And so, you know, you're there as a guide and maybe a mentor at times and even a coach at times and a confidant at times. So it's not necessarily a top-down approach. I don't think that leadership works for in many places anymore. It's more one of support. And, you know, everyone has their favourites. And for me, it's the guys who, you know, had great values and maybe not as much natural talent. So the Tom Harleys and I, we kicked off from day one. Joel Selwood and I, he's got a lot of talent though, but we kicked off from day one. Cameron Ling, we kicked off from day one. So I try not to fall in love with talent quickly, and I try to fall in love with character a lot quicker than that. Yeah, that's a bit of a motto I have.
Yeah, and obviously you've had Frank Costa as the backstop for everything done, and another strong personality, obviously.
Oh, yeah, and look at Frank, when I first knew him in 99, I went to his Dairymen office, and in his reception he had this sign up there which had big letters, character first, talent second. And so that was how he lived his life, and he had this character first program that had 52 values. It was like a religion. Every week he used to award someone around Australia for a particular behaviour. It might have been resilience, or it might have been determination, or it might have been adventurous, or whatever the case may be. He had 52 values, far too many. But, he proves it's just another way of him proving what's really important in his life. And he lives his life like that, whether it's family or whether it's football or whether it's work.
Yeah, and playing in politics in those situations, Brian, the senator, as you have referred to him before, Matty Scallard, who never had the official captaincy roles per se, yet at various stages of the Geelong Footy Club success was probably or arguably the most important person to get through. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, look, it's him and Mooney never really liked the all-in team meetings. That might be a bit harsh. They probably enjoyed the first 15 minutes and then got a bit tired after it. But if you wanted some major decisions to be made in the footy department and go through the footy department, particularly with the players, you really needed to get their support. Otherwise, a few others may not join in. And so we made sure that, you know, if they didn't really get into the leading teams concept and the you know, that we would go see them individually and just talk to them about what we're trying to do and get their approvals. And so it was like going from the lower house being the play leadership group to the upper house, the Senate. So people like Scarlo and Mooney became the senators without actually understanding what we meant, I don't think, at the time. So, you know, it's what you do with those members who don't actually join into the team, or the, you know, the team program.
Yeah. Or the minutiae of the team program.
Yeah. And you find this in any workplace, you know. There's always some effective people who just want to be on the periphery. They want to jump in and don't be way out, but they want to have some part in it. So what do you do with those?
Do you go to them first on certain
issues? You don't go to them first right. necessarily, no, because you don't want to give the impression that you're going to the outsiders first, you know. Right. I think you get the team to decide what should happen. And then you get one of the team to convince them.
Right, okay.
I don't do it.
Okay.
You get a colleague to do it.
But you're dealing with this in the back of your mind, knowing you've got to get through that person.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's cultures often have teams within teams. The Scarlets and the Moonies and a few others might have been a bit of a team within a team. And, you can try and obliterate it, but it has a disastrous effect throughout. Or you can try and massage it and manage it. And the best way to manage it is to be aware of what they need, be aware of what their wants are and their priorities, be aware of their relationships, but use the other player leaders to actually convince them.
Hmm.
Not the coach, not me. And the collegiate pressure and the collegiate influence is the one that wins them over, in my opinion, in my experience, more often than not.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. When you do have this contract expire, Brian, end of 2020, can you rule out right now that you won't seek or won't go to another footy club as CEO or renew the Geelong one?
No, I won't go to another club.
Yeah.
Not now. No, I don't need to do that. Now, I've had 20 years with the Cats and my time will come at the end of 2020.
Sure. Well, with that in mind, can you now admit to having been offered the chief executive roles at pretty much all of those 10 clubs in Melbourne over the journey?
No, I haven't had – I don't think every one of them has.
I reckon there's seven. Is there seven? Are there seven?
Oh, good. I have to go through them. But
well, let's do it. Collingwood?
Yep.
Carlton?
Yep.
Essendon?
No.
Geelong, obviously, being one of the 10. Hawthorn?
Yes.
Melbourne?
Yes.
North Melbourne, and I know the answer to this one.
What is it?
did you actually accept that North Melbourne role?
Close.
Yep.
Basically,
I think they thought
I spoke to the president as I was on my way to this is true on the way to the airport to go take my son. And the son and I went to Everest, Mount Everest. We did the best base camp trip.
Yep.
The walk, it took about 11 days to get up there, and on those 11 days, I was actually thinking on top of a mountain. It's true.
So you rang the president, who was James at the time?
Yeah, James. Yeah,
and said,
look, if I'm in the frame of mind I am now, when I get back, I'll be taking the job.
So what happened at Everest?
I got a call from Frank Costa. He got wind of what I was doing.
At base camp or somewhere along the way?
Along the way. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was along the way, yeah.
Did you fly into that Lukla airport there?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. That was,
how hairy is that?
That's devastating. It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It's think time, though, isn't it, over there?
It's really think time. Wherever you look, the scenery is just unbelievably nice. It's beautiful.
And you stayed? Obviously, after
that. And I stayed, yeah. No, I stayed, yeah.
I think there's only one cross here at this stage. Richmond?
No, I can't. I don't. No.
Yep.
No.
St Kilda?
No.
Okay. So
I might have had a chat, but never offered.
And I think the next one, Western Bulldogs.
No, oh. I haven't. No, Western Bulldogs is a no, yeah.
There's a few, though, isn't it?
There's about six, isn't there?
Yeah, I think there's six out of that. AFL chief executive.
Don't the interstate clubs count?
Oh, actually, I probably could go a bit deeper, couldn't I? Well, GWS and Gold Coast are yeses, aren't they?
GWS is not a yes.
Okay, so Gold Coast is a yes. We're up to seven. I wouldn't have thought you'd been offered the two Adelaide clubs, maybe?
I had a chat to Adelaide, but never took it any further.
I'm going to go seven and a half there, maybe. Fremantle?
Yes.
Wow.
I think it's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
And then the two times you went in varying degrees for the AFL chief executive role. You're too outspoken, Cookie, to have got those roles?
I was.
Because you're true to yourself, aren't you? I don't know, but I would imagine you would have been pretty open when you were grilled by the commission itself.
Yeah, no, I was pretty direct. The second time around I was. The first time, not so much. I was a bit younger there. The second time, I was probably too direct.
That was with the Gill and McLaughlin, the second
time?
Yeah,
there was Gill and myself and Brendan Gale. We were the three that were interviewed.
And how direct were you when you say that?
Yeah, it was pretty direct, yeah.
And what did you say?
Well, it was something along the lines of what would be the first thing you do if you come to the AFL. And I said something, you know, rather opaque, like, look, the first thing I would do is I'd really develop a mission for the AFL, its purpose in life, and then I would try and develop an industry set of values. And if we couldn't do that, we'd certainly have some for the AFL. And I'd try and work out what our competitive advantages were over the other clubs over the other sports and work on it. So those three things in combination are, a distinctive purpose, a unique set of values, and a system of advantage. Those three things, I said, that's what I'd work on. Commissioners looked at me pretty silent. Then I asked a few more other questions, and one of the commissioners said, "Oh, you mean a HR review?" And I said, "No, I'm not talking about HR review. I'm talking about something bigger than that." And I realised. And then one of the commissioners said, because I asked a few more questions, one of the commissioners said, "Look, Brian, we'll ask the questions from here." And so I knew then that my time was over in that room, and I think they'd lost a bit of interest in me by then.
Do you regret that?
No, I don't.
You were true to yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, look, there's a part of me which – it's interesting. There's a part of me which says here you have been trying to develop value-based leadership for 30 years in two clubs and trying to have some influence on the AFL. And it's been the most important aspect of my career, and the commission didn't get it. I didn't think they got it. And I said, geez, either you're wrong, Cookie, by a long shot, or they're wrong. But then there's part of me which says you are true to what your beliefs are. If that's what I would do if I went to the AFL, that's the truth. So there's a part of me which says I was honest, I was true to myself, authentic, and I asked a few questions maybe I shouldn't have, but they were direct and they were open and honest. So I'm not that worried. In fact, I'm not worried.
Is it an indictment if they didn't know what you were talking about, as you've speculated yourself, both during and since?
No, look, I'm a little bit bewildered by the reaction, because there are some great commissioners on that table who understand values and HR and mission and vision and purpose very, very, very well. But they were quiet. Most of them were quiet. So I wasn't too sure why that happened. My feeling is that Gillen probably had the job, and they were just testing who was around if something happened in the next year or two with the Essendon saga. Okay, that was that was all rolled up at the same time. I just think they were just having a look at hedging their bets and just having a look at a few options.
Okay,
that was my distinct feeling when I left.
Yeah.
And I think the commission's feeling was I took advantage of a half an hour of their time to
vent.
We
touched on the Essendon saga before, and just touched on it. You mentioned it there. Have you got some thoughts now, Brian, as now we've got 6 years beyond the revelation of it per se?
Sorry, what's that saying again, Dave?
Now that we've got 6 years beyond the Essendon saga, the first time we heard about it.
Yeah.
Do you have some strong thoughts on it now that you haven't expressed publicly before?
No, I've expressed my views previously, and I just think that, and I've done it here on the show. I just think if you play with fireworks, one or two are going to go off in your hand, and that's what they did.
Mm.
Whether they purposefully and intentionally provided the players with banned drugs, look, there was no doubt they were playing on the edge, in my opinion. And if you play on the edge, as I said, you're every now and again you're going to fall off the cliff.
Mm. We touched on you before and your roles and the jobs you've had offered to you. You've also created a lot of senior management around the game. I mean, a couple of CEOs in Stuart Fox at the MCG now, Justin Reeves, Steve Hocking even at the AFL, Rosie King, Trevor Nisbet, someone else you had under your wing back in the West Coast days. Mm. It's obviously important for you to to breed the next or help breed the next wave?
I think a good indication of an indication of a good leader is how many other leaders they develop, not how many followers they've got. You know, you do need followers because when you look around, you want them to be following. Don't get me wrong, but I think a more important aspect is how many leaders are you actually developing that can take over in your own organisation and others. So I'm. One thing that I've tried to do is identify and help grow the positive parts of people's characters and their talents. I don't concentrate too much on their weaknesses. Maybe I should, but to me, if you want to get the best out of people, I think that, you know, primarily we should be emphasising the positive parts of those people.
Yeah. Trevor is someone I'm assuming you're still close to, Brian.
Yeah, Trevor.
And did you and he find yourself talking about what he was dealing with back in that 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 period at West Coast?
Yeah, we had a few chats, but not a lot. And Izzy did it his way, and I think he did it a really good way. It was a tough time at the Eagles when Nizzy was there. I left just before all that stuff blew up, and sometimes you just have to think back and say, was it going on there? Was I part of that? You know, because as I said before, you know, it's like the iceberg above the water and the iceberg under the water. Sometimes you get cultures within cultures, you get subcultures developing under the water type thing. You don't see them; they're under the water, but they're there. And it was obvious at the West Coast Eagles that was happening with some of the younger kids who formed their own little groups and partied on their own in their own houses or in their own way without the player leadership group on the top of the iceberg actually knowing what was going on. That happens in clubs, you know. Sometimes the older player leadership don't actually know what some of the kids are doing down below. And, you know, if there's any advice I give to those people, the PLG, the player leader, say, make sure you know what the kids are doing, the young players are doing. And so we had a bit of that at the West Coast, I think. And to me, I'm saying,
even when you were there,
when I was there, I think that it must have been. I just don't think it would have happened really quickly. These things happen over time. So I'm thinking that maybe the roots, the starting of some of that stuff was when I was there. But to be honest, I don't know.
No.
And I didn't go looking for it, you know.
Yeah.
But I've learned off it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And, Brian, is it similar when you reflect now on the young Ben Cousins you first met when you were in that role at that club at that time to the one we see today? Is that similar to what you reflect upon with Mark Thompson where the person once was and that person now is? Or is it different because of the age component?
I think it's different because I think it's obvious that Ben's addictive. I don't think Mark is. I think that's the difference. Now, I don't want to pretend to be a medico or a health expert here, but that's just from the outside looking in and dealing with both Mark and I haven't dealt with Ben for many, many years. Okay, so but to me, Ben is a repeat user, and so there's some issues there. I don't believe Mark is.
Yep. And, Brian, look, we've taken up more time than I thought there, and I appreciate your openness in this. The Geelong Footy Club at which you arrived in 1999 was a complete mess, and you effectively said that at the time, and I think the industry knew it. It was dicey times for that club. The one you're going to leave in a couple of years away from now is not. Is that your proudest footy accomplishment?
Yeah, it's the the legacy. You could say it's the stadium, the premierships. You could say it's the commercial arrangement we have. But for me, it's more softer. For me, it's sort of culture before cups, you know, the two C's, but culture before, because you can't win a cup unless you've got a relatively good culture.
But you don't get the cup with it. Sorry, you don't get the culture without the cup either, though.
Oh, I'm not sure about that.
Really?
I think you've got to develop the culture first. I don't think – I reckon there's no doubt that in the history of sport in many, many competitions and that there's the odd team that wins a premiership with a poor culture. There is. That happens. And now I can mention a couple of teams in Australia which have won Australian baseball or basketball and their culture, but it only lasted a year. You can't sustain it without a good culture.
Mm.
So you can get it once off. You can't have 10 years in a row.
And the culture at the Cats is about perfect?
No, I wouldn't say it's perfect because it's a never-ending battle. You've got to touch every corner of the organisation, and it's impossible with part-timers and casual and having 600 staff. But what you've got to do as a leader is be really honest and fair dinkum about having a crack at this, and people know that you're honest about getting to the position where all people show all the values all the time. But it's a philosophy. You never get there. It's like zero deaths on the road. Mm. It doesn't happen. But you've got to have a leader that actually works towards that aim.
Yeah. Brian Crook, thanks for your time today, and thanks for the time you've given and the openness inside that time.
Thanks very much, Damo. Good on you, mate.